If I were to ask you right now to just point to yourself, you would likely gesture toward your chest.
Right, it's an instinct.
Exactly. It is a completely natural, almost reflexive movement. But if we were to take your physical body, your passing feelings, your ability to recognize objects and lay them all out on a table, separated from one another, where exactly do you live?
Well, nowhere you can physically pinpoint.
Right. 2.5 millennia ago, the Buddha argued that the solid, independent you that we all defend so fiercely, the self that flares up in anger, is actually a hallucination.
A very convincing hallucination.
Yes, a profound trick of the mind. So today, we are taking a deep dive into the mechanics of that illusion. And we are not merely summarizing a text here. We are entering into a formal Dharma teaching, analyzing a direct transmission of established wisdom.
That is precisely the threshold we are crossing today. The source material for this deep dive is, well, it's incredibly precious. We're examining a comprehensive 13-session commentary on the Prajnaparamita Hridaya.
Which is universally known as the Heart Sutra, right?
Exactly. And this teaching was delivered by the Venerable Khyentse Rinpoche, Geshe Lobsang Thubten, at Buddha House in Adelaide, South Australia.
And this is back in the year 2000, correct?
Yes, over several months, between October and December of 2000.
We really need to establish the historical and emotional weight of this specific series because it sets the tenor for everything we are going to discuss today.
Absolutely. It wasn't just another semester on the calendar.
No, not at all. This was Khyentse Rinpoche's final teaching series before his formal retirement. It concluded 12 years of uninterrupted service to that specific community.
It really was a parting gift to his students.
Exactly. It is the culmination of a lifetime of intensive monastic study that he began at the age of 20, distilled into practical wisdom.
It is a profound offering of lineage. The text he chose, the Heart Sutra, is known in Tibetan as the Sherab Ningpo.
Which translates to what exactly?
It translates beautifully as the essence of wisdom. Khyentse Rinpo described it as the absolute gist of all wisdoms. It's the beating heart of the entire Mahayana teaching.
Right, so to comprehend this brief sutra is to hold the key to the vast perfection of wisdom sutras.
Exactly. But as Khyentse Rinpoche was meticulously careful to instruct his students, you don't just walk into the architecture of emptiness without preparing the mind first.
That preparation is so vital. I often think about this intellectual preparation like trying to plant a very delicate seed.
You can't just throw it on dry concrete.
Right, you can't throw a seed onto hardened concrete and expect it to take root. The mind must be conditioned. So how did Khyentse Rinpoche frame this required mindset?
Well, he established, with the absolute clarity of his scholastic background, that realizing emptiness requires the unbreakable unification of wisdom and merit.
Which means wisdom alone isn't enough.
Exactly. He cited the great Indian scholar Aryadeva to emphasize that wisdom alone, stripped of the altruistic intention, is completely insufficient for awakening.
So that's why every single one of those 13 sessions opened with a generation of Bodhicitta.
Yes. Bodhicitta is the altruistic, unshakable intention to attain full enlightenment, specifically for the ultimate benefit of all sentient beings.
Let's pause and unpack that because I want to ensure we don't glide over this term. To the Western ear, generating love for all beings can sound, well, dangerously close to vague sentimentality.
Right, like a nice wishful idea.
Exactly. So how does the classical Gelug tradition, which Khyentse Rinpoche represented, prevent this from just being passive sentimentality?
It's structured as a very precise, sequential science of the mind. You don't begin by trying to love everyone, because that's impossible for an untrained mind.
So where do you begin?
You begin by generating equanimity, leveling the field, so you no longer categorize beings into friends, enemies, and strangers.
And from that flat ground, you cultivate compassion.
Yes. And compassion here isn't pity. It is the agonizing wish that all motherly sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes.
And from compassion, the practitioner then generates love. Why does love follow compassion in this specific sequence?
Because once you've wished for their freedom from torment, you actively wish for their flourishing. Love is the servant wish that all beings possess happiness.
And I think this is the genius of the Mahayana method. Compassion and love alone are still not bodhicitta, right?
Correct. They are beautiful, but they can remain passive. They have to culminate in what is called a special intention.
Which is when the practitioner takes personal responsibility.
Exactly. The practitioner internalizes the vow, I myself will bring about this freedom and this perfect happiness for all beings.
That is an immense, almost crushing weight of responsibility to place on oneself.
It is. And the logical mind immediately recognizes a problem. You realize, I am an ordinary being burdened by ignorance. I can't possibly save countless beings.
So what's the solution?
Because only a fully awakened Buddha has the omniscient capacity to actually accomplish this, the practitioner resolves to attain Buddhahood as the necessary tool.
And that resulting determination is Bodhisattva.
Yes. That is the ultimate merit field.
Khyentser Rinpoche noted there are two main fields of merit. You have the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, to whom you make offerings. And then you have all sentient beings toward whom you cultivate this bodhicitta.
Both fields are absolutely necessary to build the immense store of merit that allows the mind to actually comprehend reality without breaking.
Because without that merit acting as a stabilizing force, the mind just lacks the strength to pierce the illusion of inherent existence.
It will completely rebel against the teaching. Khyentser Rinpoche illustrated this beautifully by quoting the revered Indian master, Chandrakirti.
Oh, the description of the ideal disciple.
Yes. Chandrakirti describes someone who, upon merely hearing the word emptiness, experiences a profound physical reaction. The hairs on their bodies stand on end and tears of joy come to their eyes.
I find that image so moving, but we should clarify this isn't out of mere sentimentality, right?
Exactly. It's not a worldly emotional breakdown. It occurs because the teaching activates deep, dormant imprints from past lives of practice.
The joy is the joy of recognition.
Yes. And I love the humor Khyentser Rinpoche brought to this moment. Looking out at his students in Adelaide, who might have felt intimidated by this standard, he just smiled and said, I'm pretty sure you have this, because you are all here.
That is such a welcoming gesture. It validates their presence. So with that foundation of bodhicitta established, we can turn to the text itself. Even the title is a profound teaching.
Yes, the Sanskrit title, Bhagavati Prajnaparamita Vidaya.
Let's walk through this nomenclature, starting with the first word, Bhagavati.
In Tibetan, Bhagavati is translated as Chamdema, which means the great destroyer.
But we need to be clear about what is being destroyed. This isn't a worldly battle.
No, it refers specifically to the destruction of the four Maras, the demonic interferences that prevent a being from achieving enlightenment.
I think we need to define those four Maras for the listener. What is the first Mara?
The first is the Mara of disturbing emotions. This encompasses the root poisons of the mind: ignorance, attachment, anger, pride, and jealousy.
The internal forces that compel us to create negative karma. And the second is the Mara of death. But this isn't just the biological cessation of a heartbeat, is it?
Correct. It refers to the uncontrolled, involuntary passing from one life to the next under the sway of karma. It's the interruption of practice.
And the third is the Mara of the devas.
Yes, the divine youth. This refers to actual external obstructors, subtle beings or forces that actively try to hinder a practitioner's progress.
Like through extreme distractions or inflating the ego.
Exactly. False visions, sudden worldly successes, that sort of thing.
And the fourth Mara.
The fourth is the Mara of the body, or the aggregates themselves. Taking a contaminated physical body inevitably brings tiredness, sickness, and physical pain.
So the perfection of wisdom is the great destroyer, because realizing emptiness eradicates all four of these Maras completely from the root.
Yes, so they can never grow back.
That brings us to the second part of the title, Prajnaparamita. Prajna translates to wisdom, and paramita means perfection, or gone beyond.
Khyentser Rinpoche was highly analytical here. He explained that wisdom gone beyond must be understood in three distinct senses.
Let's go through them. The first sense.
First, it refers to the path gone beyond, the active journey, the meditations and realizations spanning the five Mahayana paths.
Second, it refers to the text gone beyond, the physical sutra itself.
Yes, the spoken and written words that act as the vehicle. And the third sense is the resultant wisdom gone beyond.
Which is the ultimate goal, the direct, non-conceptual realization of emptiness in the mind of a fully awakened being.
Precisely. Which brings us to the final word of the title, Hridaya. This simply means heart or essence.
Khyentser Rinpoche offered a really beautiful physiological analogy for this, didn't he?
He did. He taught that just as our physical life force and subtle consciousness gather at the physical heart within the body, the wisdom that realizes emptiness is the core of all the Buddha's teachings.
If you remove emptiness, the Dharma ceases to beat.
It is the vital organ of the path.
And this brings us to the prologue of the sutra. It's spoken by Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and attendant, who begins with, "Thus I have heard."
Right. And in those few words, Khyentser Rinpoche identifies the four excellences. These establish the supreme authority of the teaching.
Let's explore those. The first is the excellent time.
That's the precise historical moment when Buddha Shakyamuni was physically present in the world, turning the wheel of Dharma.
The second is the excellent teacher.
The Buddha himself. The incomparable guide who has completely purified his mind.
The third is the excellent place. Vulture Peak, near Rajgir in ancient India.
Kenzo Rinpoche's description of this environment was deeply evocative. He noted that the hill itself resembles a vulture resting with folded wings.
And he shared a very specific, intimate detail about the stones there.
Yes. He mentioned that if you walk on those hills, you find countless tiny stones scattered about. And remarkably, each little stone is shaped like a miniature vulture.
He used that detail to emphasize the immense spiritual gravity of the location, right?
Absolutely. He stated that by merely visiting such profoundly holy places with pure faith, the blessings are so potent, they act as a karmic shield.
Preventing a lower rebirth for at least one entire lifetime, that is astonishing. And the fourth excellence is the excellent disciples.
This wasn't a small gathering. The sutra describes a vast cosmic assembly, human monks, bodhisattvas, and countless gods and demigods.
Including the Gandharvas, the celestial musicians.
The entire cosmos leaned in to hear this definitive teaching.
And yet, what happens next in the prologue is so puzzling, the Buddha doesn't actually speak the core verses.
Right, he enters into a profound meditative equipoise called the perception of the profound.
He just sits in total radiant silence, and the actual dialogue happens between two disciples, Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara.
It's a remarkable narrative structure.
I have to pause here. If this is the highest Mahayana teaching, why doesn't the Buddha just speak it himself?
It's a vital question regarding skillful memes. Kinsa Rinpoche likened the Buddha to a prime minister who writes a nation-changing speech, but for strategic reasons, asks his trusted secretary to read it aloud.
So the Buddha empowered them through his meditative stabilization to have this conversation.
Exactly. And the choice of these two specific messengers is karmically perfect.
Let's look at Shariputra, who asks the initiating question. He's renowned for his extraordinary intellect, but he is an arhat of the foundational vehicle.
Yes, and we should define what an arhat is here.
Please do. Why is an arhat asking this question so significant?
Well, an arhat is a practitioner who has completely eradicated the disturbing emotions. They've attained personal liberation or nirvana.
But they haven't attained the full enlightenment of a Buddha.
Right, because they haven't eradicated the subtle cognitive obscurations, which requires vast bodhicitta.
So why is a practitioner of the foundational vehicle asking about the highest Mahayana teaching?
Kinsa Rinpoche explained, it's a supreme act of skillful means. Because of his status as a hero of the lower vehicle, his inquiries are perfectly tailored to draw out the teachings that lower vehicle practitioners and ordinary beings like us most desperately need to hear.
It's a bridge to shift our minds toward the great vehicle.
And Kinsa Rinpoche provided the karmic backstory for Shariputra's legendary intellect. It wasn't a random genetic gift.
Oh, the story about the lamp offering.
Yes, unimaginably long ago, during the time of the Buddha Krakushanda, he made a simple offering of a single lamp to a painted image of that Buddha.
And because of the pure motivation, the karmic result ripened into the sharpest wisdom among all disciples.
Then we have the responder, Avalokiteshvara, or Chenrezig, the embodiment of limitless compassion.
Why is Avalokiteshvara chosen to provide the definitive answer?
Because when a teaching on the cold, hard, profound nature of reality is given by someone possessing such immense, warm-hearted bodhicitta, it carries an entirely different energetic weight.
The delivery mechanism of ultimate truth must always be ultimate compassion.
Exactly. The immense kind-heartedness acts as a solvent, allowing the sharp blade of wisdom to penetrate the disciples' minds without causing fear.
So Shariputra asks his piercing question. How should those who wish to practice the profound perfection of wisdom train?
And Avalokiteshvara answers by instructing the bodhisattva to look at the five aggregates and see that they are empty of inherent existence.
To understand this, we have to carefully deconstruct our reality. What exactly are the five aggregates, or the skandhas?
They are the fundamental components that make up our entire physical and mental reality. We think we are a solid person, but we are actually a compilation of these five heaps.
Kinsa Rinpoche used a highly relatable analogy from Vasubandhu to explain this, right? The analogy of eating a meal.
Yes, it grounds the soaring philosophy perfectly. Let's walk through it. The first aggregate is form.
Which refers to all material phenomena, the physical body, the objects of the senses.
Right. And in the meal analogy, form is represented by the plate itself. It's the physical vessel.
The second aggregate is feeling. And we need to clarify this because in English, feeling usually implies complex emotions like jealousy or love.
That's a very common misunderstanding. In Buddhist psychology, feeling is just the raw, immediate aggregate of sensation. It's the sorting of experience into pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral.
So in the analogy, feeling is represented by the plain rice on the plate.
Yes, the base substance of what we experience directly.
The third aggregate is recognition.
Recognition is the mental factor that actively distinguishes what is what. It perceives characteristics, distinguishing hot from cold, a friend from a stranger.
And in the meal analogy, recognition is the curry or the rich spices added to the rice.
Exactly. It gives distinct flavor and identity to the raw experience.
The fourth aggregate is compositional factors. This always sounds like a catch-all category.
It is broad. It includes all other mental factors, but primarily our volitional activities, our intentions, karmic impulses, the urges that propel us to act.
So in the analogy, this would be the coordinated hand movements, gathering the rice, mixing it, lifting it to the mouth.
Yes, the driving force, the action.
And the fifth aggregate is consciousness.
Consciousness is the primary mind itself, the mirror-like awareness in which all the other things arise and appear.
The person who is actually sitting there eating the meal.
Exactly. The base awareness experiencing the entire event.
We experience these five aggregates constantly and view them as fundamentally me and mine, but Avalokiteshvara instructs us to see them as entirely empty.
Kensur Rinpoche demonstrates how to apply the four emptinesses to each aggregate, starting with form. And he gave a stern warning here.
Right. He said, if you don't understand how this applies to the first aggregate, don't move on.
Yes. He said it becomes like getting the second stick on the head. The confusion just compounds. So we must examine form very deliberately.
The first statement is the most famous line. Form is emptiness.
This is a surgical strike against our normal perception. It means that form your physical body, the plate is completely empty of inherent existence.
It doesn't exist from its own side independently.
Right. It refutes the extreme of eternalism, which is the false belief that things have a solid, unchanging essence hidden within them.
I have to pause you there. This is exactly where the Western brain panics. When we hear form is emptiness, we instantly jump to nihilism.
Oh, absolutely.
We think, okay, if it has no essence, it isn't real. The world is a mirage. Nothing matters. How did Kensur Rinpoche prevent students from falling off that cliff?
He used a brilliantly simple example, a common cup. He held it up and said, when we say the cup is empty, it does not mean the cup does not exist. What it means is the cup contains nothing.
In this context, it contains no inherent existence.
Exactly. The cup exists conventionally. It holds hot water. If you drop it, it shatters. It functions perfectly. But it is empty of a fixed essence.
So the sutra immediately follows with emptiness is form.
Meaning the very nature of form's existence is its emptiness. Because it is empty of a frozen essence, it is fluid enough to arise as form when the right causes and conditions meet.
That beautifully refutes nihilism, which leads to the third statement. Form is not other than emptiness.
This indicates that form and its emptiness are one single entity, distinguished conceptually by different names. Kensur Rinpoche used a linguistic analogy here.
The Tibetan word for flower, right?
Yes. In everyday Tibetan, a flower is metok. But in classical poetry, there are archaic words for the exact same flower. Different names, same physical entity.
Conventional form and ultimate emptiness are the exact same entity. You cannot pull them apart. And the final statement, emptiness is not other than form.
This prevents us from spiritualizing emptiness into a separate mystical void floating in space. You cannot find the emptiness of the cup anywhere other than exactly where the cup is.
So once we analyze form this way, we apply it to feeling, recognition, compositional factors, and consciousness. But Kensur Rinpoche made a vital correction for practice on the cushion.
Yes, he emphasized that we must meditate on the selflessness of the person before the selflessness of phenomena.
Why is my ego the priority over the cup on my desk?
Because our attachment to our own ego, to the I, is the most visceral and damaging form of grasping. It's the root of our suffering.
It's easy to see the lack of inherent existence in a ceramic cup. It doesn't trigger our survival instincts.
But seeing the emptiness of the I that is terrified of dying is incredibly difficult. If we don't dismantle the false I first, our realization is just an intellectual parlor trick.
To explain how this false I is constructed, Kensur Rinpoche used the famous analogy of the rope and the snake. Let's walk through this step by step.
Imagine it's early morning, dim light. A person walks into a room and sees a coiled black and white rope on the floor.
Because the lighting is poor, representing ignorance, they instantly mistake the rope for a venomous snake.
The physiological reaction is immediate. Adrenaline floods their system. They feel genuine terror.
But the snake didn't just magically appear. Kencer and Posh broke down the four elements that produced it. First, the basis of labeling.
The basis, the physical rope itself, the coiled shape, the colors. It's the raw material upon which the confused mind projects fear.
Second, the sound or the name?
The person makes the internal mental sound. Snake. The conceptual label is drawn from memory.
Third, the misconceptual thought.
The mind actively combines the visual data with the label, formulating the solid belief that a dangerous snake is on the floor.
And fourth, the grasping.
The mind fiercely holds on to that thought as absolute reality. It grasps the rope as a real snake.
The result is profound. Kensa Rinpoche said, for that person within his mind, he has produced one snake on the table.
But the snake does not exist from its own side. It is entirely a production of the mind's mistaken conceptualization.
So how do we apply this analogy on the cushion? How do you find the snake in your own mind?
Kensa Rinpoche said you have to locate the eye that flares up in moments of strong emotion. You can't look for it when you are relaxed.
He instructed students to think about a moment when they were harshly accused of something or heavily praised.
Yes. In that split second, a very solid metallic eye flares up right in the center of the chest. How dare they say that about me?
That flaring defensive light, that is the snake. Let's map the analogy perfectly. What is the basis of labeling for the self?
The basis is the five aggregates we just discussed. They are the coiled rope.
And the name.
The name is the sound applied to those aggregates, like your given name.
And the misconceptual thought and grasping.
The mind looks at the shifting stream of aggregates, hears the name, and firmly grasps. This is me. I am this solid, independent entity.
Through these three, the basis, the name, and the grasping, the inherently existent I is produced as a total hallucination.
Now, Kensa Rinpoche was adamant that we must define the object of negation with microscopic precision.
We aren't trying to meditate until we believe we don't exist. That's nihilism again.
Correct. The I that does exist is the nominally labeled I, the conventional I. It functions, it speaks, it experiences karma. We are not negating that.
So what exactly doesn't exist? What is the target?
What does not exist is the I that appears to exist by its own accord, independently, from its own side, without depending on the aggregates or the label.
That second eye is the snake, and you have to see it clearly to shoot it down.
That's exactly. Kensa Rinpoche pointed out the logical absurdity of believing in this inherently existent eye. He used the example of a person named Tashi.
Right. If Tashi existed inherently, independently, what is the fault in that?
The fault is that life becomes impossible, he explained. If Tashi exists independently, then Tashi can never grow old. We never die.
Because an inherently existent thing is independent of causes and conditions. It can't be affected by them.
It's frozen in time. If a seed existed inherently, it could never transform into a sprout. The entire universe of cause and effect relies entirely upon the fact that things lack inherent existence.
Change and enlightenment are only possible because things are empty. Which brings us to the ultimate tool used to dismantle this inherent I, the logic of dependent arising.
Yes, Pratityasamutpada. This is the precise logical weapon utilized by Chandrakirti.
The syllogism is devastating to the ego. It states, because the I arises depending on parts, a name, and conceptual thought, it cannot possibly exist independently.
Dependence and independence are mutually exclusive states.
Kensa Rinpoche explained that dependent arising is understood at three different levels of subtlety. Let's walk through them. The gross level.
The gross level is the basic understanding that things arise through the meeting of causes and conditions. A plant grows because of the seed, soil, water, and sunlight.
Then the subtle level.
This states that things exist by depending on their parts. A chariot exists in dependence on its wheels, axle, and carriage. This view is championed by the autonomist Madhyamaka school.
And finally, the most subtle level, which Kensa Rinpoche identifies as the absolute pinnacle of Buddhist philosophy.
The most subtle level asserts that things exist solely by depending on three things: the basis of imputation, the name, and the conceptual thought that labels the name onto the basis.
There is absolutely nothing existing from the side of the object itself.
Exactly. This is the unique hallmark of the Prasenjika Madhyamaka school, the utmost school of the tenets.
He quoted the Buddha to emphasize this. Whoever sees dependent arising will see the Dharma. By realizing emptiness, one achieves Buddhahood.
It's the golden key. But we have to clarify a subtle distinction regarding the Prasangika view here.
Yes, because lower schools assume that if something exists, it must exist by its own characteristic. It must have some inherent essence. How does the Prasangika school solve this?
This is their unparalleled genius. The Prasangika radically separates existence from inherent existence. They are not synonymous.
Meaning something can exist functionally without existing by its own characteristic.
Exactly. And just because something lacks inherent existence, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist at all. The formulation is, because it exists, therefore it is empty of inherent existence.
Its very emptiness is the proof of its conventional reality. It exists as a dependent arising. But this raises a practical question. If everything is just a conceptual label, can I just label a dog as a cat and make it so?
Khyentse Rinpoche addressed this head-on by explaining the difference between valid and invalid fabrication. He used an analogy from metallurgy.
The copper and gold analogy.
Yes. Imagine a solid lump of copper. You can conceptualize it as gold, you can label it gold, but that is an invalid fabrication.
Because it will never function as gold, it won't melt or conduct like gold, the basis is not suitable for the label.
Precisely. But labeling person onto the five aggregates is a valid fabrication.
Because the aggregates are actually suitable to perform the functions of a person. They can walk, think, communicate.
So the person exists conventionally as a valid nominal reality, whereas the copper gold does not.
This philosophical balancing act was perfectly summarized by a quote from Lama Tsongkhapa. Appearance stops true existence, and emptiness stops nihilism.
Let's unpack that. Appearance stops true existence means that because things appear and function, we know they are dependent on causes and conditions.
And since they are dependent, they cannot possess true independent existence.
Exactly. The mere fact that the cup appears is proof that it is empty. And the second half, emptiness stops nihilism.
Because things are empty of a frozen existence, they are adaptable and able to function in a web of causality.
Their emptiness is exactly what allows them to exist conventionally. Mm-hmm. Dependent arising and emptiness are one single truth.
Understanding this logic is the theory, but walking the path to direct realization is the actual practice. How does the Heart Sutra map out the stages of an awakening mind?
The sutra contains the sweeping line, no ignorance and no extinction of ignorance. This is Avalokiteshvara systematically applying emptiness to the 12 limbs of interdependent arising.
The nidanas. These describe the exact sequence of gears by which sentient beings circle endlessly in samsara. Ignorance, karma, consciousness, and so on.
Yes, and Khyentse Rinpoche wanted his students to truly feel the trapped nature of this process. He used a hyperlocal metaphor for the students in Adelaide.
The Royal Adelaide Show.
Yes. He likened cyclic existence to the giant Ferris wheel there. He said, the kids go in a huge, gigantic wheel. We circle like that.
Driven entirely by the relentless engine of the 12 limbs. So how do you stop the Ferris wheel?
You don't fight the symptoms. You find the main switch. He said, cut the wire connection and the wheel suddenly stops.
And that main electrical switch is the very first limb, ignorance. The ignorance that grasps at inherent existence.
He also used the metaphor of a destructive waterfall. If you want to stop the flooding, you don't build 100 tiny dams. You go to the source.
Obstruct the main source of the river ignorance and you protect all the cities downstream from karma, aging, and death.
When a practitioner finally cuts that wire, achieving direct realization of emptiness, they reach the path of seeing. At this moment, they arrive at the three doors of liberation.
The first is the door of emptiness, or entitylessness.
The realization that all phenomena by their own entity are entirely empty of inherent existence.
The second is the door of signlessness.
This focuses backward on the causes. It's the realization that all causes that produce phenomena are also free of inherent existence.
The seeds, the water, the sunlight, all empty. And the third is the door of wishlessness.
This focuses forward on the results. All results arising from those causes are unproduced inherently.
Khyentse Rinpoche compared these three doors to the entrance of Buddha House itself. Once you reach them, you are standing at the threshold, step inside, and you are in liberation.
This logical progression brings us to the ultimate culmination of the sutra, the concluding mantra. Gegate Parasamgate Bodhisvaha.
Khyentse Rinpoche explained that this mantra is actually a hidden map of the five Mahayana paths to enlightenment. Let's break it down. The first word is gate, meaning go.
This corresponds to the path of accumulation. The practitioner is developing the wisdom of emptiness through contemplation and analytical meditation. It culminates in calm, abiding, focused on emptiness.
The second word is again, gate, go.
This represents the transition to the path of preparation. The meditation deepens, realizing emptiness via a generic image. It's conceptual, but intensely vivid.
When they reach the highest level of this path, the very next moment changes their status forever.
This is represented by Paragate Go Beyond.
Paragate signifies the path of seeing, the definitive breakthrough. The generic image drops away, and they experience the first direct, non-conceptual realization of emptiness. They step onto the first bodhisattva ground, the joyous ground.
And they completely and permanently overcome 220 specific obscurations.
The next word is parasamgate, go completely beyond.
This corresponds to the path of meditation. They must familiarize themselves with ultimate truth repeatedly, deepening the realization across the remaining 9 bodhisattva grounds.
There is a vital technical point here about the non-appearance of conventional phenomena during meditative equipoise. We need to clarify this so listeners don't think the universe just vanishes.
It's a crucial distinction. Khyentse Rinpoche emphasized, it doesn't mean these things don't exist. The mountains and buildings don't disappear from conventional reality.
It means they become non-appearances inside the perception of the meditating mind.
Exactly. The mind is so utterly absorbed in emptiness that the conventional surface of reality fades from perception temporarily.
And finally, the mantra concludes with Bodhisvaha, may enlightenment be established.
This represents the path of no more learning, full Buddhahood. They enter a Vajra-like meditative equipoise that destroys the very last, most subtle obscuration to omniscience.
Khyentse Rinpo described it definitively. One has no obscuration, no fear towards emptiness. Within a moment, one attains Buddhahood.
He also noted that mantra translates to mind protection. The wisdom realizing emptiness protects the mind in the ultimate sense, purifying it of all obscurations.
This vast, detailed map of awakening was the culmination of his doctrinal instruction. But as he closed his final teaching session, he brought all this immense philosophy down to the daily cushion.
He spoke with profound humility, saying, "The teachings I have given you in the last 12 years are the teachings I have practiced and trained in, starting from the age of 20.
He was explicitly passing on a living, unbroken lineage, and he ensured continuity by introducing his successor, Geshe Pema Tsering.
He then summarized his practice advice. First, he pleaded with students not to let these teachings remain mere intellectual data.
Right, he said. Bring all hearings into contemplation and all contemplations into meditation. Don't leave the understanding as understanding.
To assist with this, he strongly recommended the daily recitation of the Arupakana mantra, the mantra of Manjushri, the Buddha of wisdom,
to clear away mental fog and penetrate these subtle truths. He also gave a very grounded daily assignment. Meditate for just 5 minutes a day on dependent arising.
Yes. He promised that even a brief 5-minute session harms the samsara or ignorance very strongly. You don't need to be a fully realized bodhisattva to begin dismantling the maras.
And perhaps the most comforting promise he made concerned the karmic imprints we are creating right now by studying this.
Realizing emptiness directly in this lifetime is profoundly difficult. But he assured students the effort is never wasted. By engaging with this teaching, you plant indestructible karmic seeds.
He promised that in a future life, even a brief teaching from the future Buddha Maitreya will cause the realization to sprout instantly.
The confusing work you do today, parsing out the logic, guarantees your future liberation.
So, as we conclude this profound transmission, I want to leave you with a direct application of Khyentse Rinpoche's wisdom. Think about the I, not the theoretical I, but the visceral one.
The one that reacts.
Yes. The next time you are harshly criticized today, or the next time you feel a warm surge of pride at a compliment, I want you to stop and watch. Watch that solid, seemingly independent I flare up in the center of your chest. Feel how incredibly real, how undeniable it seems in that heated moment. And in that exact second, when the emotion is hottest, ask yourself, where exactly is the snake in the rope?